Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel talk show on multiple myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor at the Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is Cure Panel's 64th episode, and on our myeloma broadcast today, we are discussing myeloma updates from ASCO 2014. My co-host for the show today is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are Cure panelists Pat Killingsworth, Jack Aiello, Nick Van Dyke, and Cynthia Shmilevsky. We have a very eminent expert with us today, Dr. Shaji Kumar from Mayo Clinic. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kumar. It's a pleasure to have you with us once again. Before I hand over to Gary to introduce the expert and begin with the show, I would like to mention to the audience that if you have a question for Dr. Kumar, please press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you on air to ask your question. Or you can even email me, Priya@trialx.com, with your question. Gary will now introduce us to expert. Gary, you're live on air.
Well, Priya, thank you so much, and if I haven't said it enough, I hope I can tell you how important you are to the whole effort we have informing the myeloma patient community, and I appreciate all of your efforts. Dr. Kumar, this is the second year that you've been with us, and I must admit that you are one of the remarkable members of what I consider the Mayo Myeloma Dream Team. And, you know, I think there's very few institutions in the world that have assembled such a great team to fight against this deadly disease, multiple myeloma. And we certainly do appreciate all of your efforts. I won't get into your extensive bio because you have an unbelievably great bio and many publications and all the rest, but just the fact that you are a member of this fantastic team is remarkable unto itself. So thank you so much for being here, and we would like to get going with your presentation of 2014 ASCO.
Thanks, Gary. That is really kind of you. It's you know, it's all teamwork, right? So it needs everyone's involved in there, including all the patients. Just kind of getting into the ASCO 2014. Clearly, ASCO. Represents not as many new data as the ASH meetings typically have, since it encompasses all cancers, including hematological cancers. But it clearly shows, you know, what it's some of the highlights of what's happening in the myeloma world. So I think, you know, if you were to go through, there were almost, I think, close to 100 abstracts, including talks and posters that were related to multiple myeloma. So I'm just kind of going to go ahead and break them into several groups, depending upon kind of what category they belong to. I think one of the most exciting things, and I know some of those things are going to come up in the questions later on, I think is the monoclonal antibodies, clearly one of the most promising things that we have seen, both at the last year's ASH and also again at ASCO this year, where we have more data. So it's different monoclonal antibodies that are being developed almost in parallel here, as well as the Sanofi monoclonal antibody. And there were two presentations from each of those drugs, one alone and one in combination with Revlimid. And while these studies are fairly early on, I think the results that we are seeing so far is very encouraging. As a single agent, these drugs have resulted in a partial response in almost a third of patients or better in a group of patients who have seen a variety of different treatments before. And in combination with Revlimid, it appears that we are seeing some synergy and the response rates were even higher. when they were used in combination with Revlimid. And this kind of ties in with, you know, what we believe is one of the strongest mechanisms of action of Revlimid, which is the ability to enhance the immune system. So at least even theoretically, the combination of those two should make even the antibodies work much better, because these antibodies do kind of harness the immune system to some extent in its activity. So I think the next year or two is going to be pretty exciting from this particular class of drugs. We're going to start seeing a lot of these different combinations. We're going to start seeing them in the relapsed patient population, patients with newly diagnosed myeloma, and potentially also in some of those maintenance settings. So I think the monoclonal antibody is clearly on the top of the list for things that we need to be watching out for in the next few years. And the clinical trials, there's quite a few of them that are being planned, and many of them would start accruing patients in the next few months to a year. You know, I would encourage all patients to consider participating in some of those trials. So the second, I think the big thing that was presented was the Panorama trial, or the Panobinostat. So that is, again, you know, the theme of all the new drugs that's coming along in myeloma. This is, again, is a pill. We have kind of seen that class of drugs before. We saw the Vorinostat trial, and we really did not see a significant advantage of adding Vorinostat to bortezomib. But the data that was presented by Dr. Richardson at ASCO, looking at the combination of Panobinostat with bortezomib or Velcade versus Velcade alone, clearly showed that addition of Panobinostat to the Velcade improved the response rates, and they also improved the progression-free survival in patients. So I think, you know, that is quite exciting in the sense there's another class of drug which clearly demonstrates an improvement in progression-free survival, and I think we'll come to some of those nuances of the PFS, what are the implications of the PFS in progression-free survival improvement in the latter part of the panelist session. The other kind of a concept that I want to, that had several abstracts which kind of belong to that theme, was the duration of treatment. And I know it's one of the most hotly debated topics in myeloma today, is how long of a treatment is ideal. To that extent, I think, you know, there's some very early results of a couple of trials looking at Revlimid kind of given us maintenance treatment after non-Revlimid type of treatments in the initial part of myeloma therapy. I think these trials are very early on to say anything about. However, there was the thalidomide prednisone maintenance trial that was originally published several years ago now from the Australian group, and where they actually looked at an updated follow-up, almost a 2 more years of follow-up in those patient population. And they were able to show that the improvement in the progression-free survival was still present when you gave thalpred maintenance after stem cell transplant. However, I think a note of caution when you interpret all this data is the fact that they actually saw no improvement in the overall survival. If anything, the curves were starting to come together, suggesting that we are not going to see any improvement in the overall survival in that maintenance patient population, even if we continue to follow them. So one of those things we always talk about is, oh, well, we see a big PFS improvement today and the overall survival improvement will come later. That may be true for some, but it's not necessarily a given fact, and this trial tends goes ways to highlight that.
Kumar, just one point of note. Did that include dexamethasone with the Revlimid, or was it just Revlimid by itself?
So this is thalidomide and prednisone.
Oh, okay.
Thalidomide and prednisone, not Revlimid. This is the Australian trial.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, this is the only one we have a median follow-up. It's almost like 6.1 years now. But all the Revlimid maintenance trial, we still have relatively, you know, around four to five-year follow-up at this point.
Yeah, and that's the one I guess I was wondering whether it included dexamethasone or not.
No, it just it included prednisone. So that's the only one.
Okay, thank you.
So The other thing I think we'll, again, come to it in the panelist session was this whole concept about the PFS2 or the progression-free survival 2. And so I'm going to leave that alone for right now, and we'll talk about it later. A few other ones I wanted to highlight. One is the results of the Champion trial. That is a trial that is looking at once a week of carfilzomib instead of or Kyprolis instead of 2 times a week. Now, we all know from the results so far that the Kyprolis is a relative, it's an active medication and can lead to disease control in a significant proportion of patients who have failed all other different therapies in the past. So one of the biggest concern has been the need to go into the clinic 2 times a week to get injections. So this trial actually explores the possibility of doing just once a week, but giving it at a higher dose. And they have, in the current study, they have gone on to doses as high as 70 milligrams per meter square, which is almost 2.5 times what is the current label on current dose on the label when it's given once a week. And seems to be relatively safe, and they are seeing results in terms of myeloma control similar to what they have seen with the 2 times a week. So I think it's very early results, and obviously we had to be confirmed in some kind of a randomized trial. But I think it certainly, increases the possibility that in sometime in future we may be able to get away with just one injection a week instead of 2 injections a week. So it's kind of similar to what we did, what was done with the Velcade, going from 2 times a week to one time a week, and or going with different ways of administering it. The another trial that is a precursor to a phase 3 trial is the one that is looking at the combination of pomalidomide, Velcade, and dexamethasone. Now, this, again, is the initial part of the trial that Dr. Richardson presented, suggesting that, yes, those drugs can be combined safely, and we do see a significant anti-myeloma effect from this drug combination. So that's another combination to be keeping an eye out for. Now, there were two studies which were not like clinical trials, but more of looking at experience over time of the combination of Velcade, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone, or Cybo-D, as it's commonly known. So both of them were, these studies came from one from Canada, one from the Mayo Clinic Scottsdale. Both, again, highlighted that this is a very effective combination and something to be kept in mind when patients have disease that has relapsed. There was another study from Dr. Siegel that looked at the combination of the carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and adding vorinostat to that. So again, adding that new class of drugs, the what we call the HDAC inhibitors or the histone deacetylase inhibitors. This is the same class of drug as the penobinostat. So vorinostat, penobinostat, and other drugs that are currently in development all belong to this class. So this is, again, very early on, but, again, kind of suggesting that we are continuing to push the envelope, trying to see how can we actually combine these different classes of medications to further improve the outcomes. There was another study that was presented by some data that we had analyzed using the SEER database, looking at patients with plasma cell leukemia. Now, this is a relatively rare group of patients, especially when you're talking about initial diagnosis, and tends to have very aggressive disease course. And when we looked at this year database over a 30-year period, what we were able to see was there's clear improvement in survival even in patients with the aggressive plasma cell leukemia. Certainly not to the same extent as what we have seen with myeloma, but still over time these patients are also doing better, suggesting that the various medications and combinations we are using nowadays clearly seems to be of benefit. So finally, I just want to highlight a couple of studies that were looking at the quality of life. Now, I think that is something that we are, we have for a longest time not really looked at, but I think increasingly we are starting to look at that because patients with myeloma are living longer and longer, and we certainly need to give a lot of attention to the quality of life aspects. And our goal is obviously to extend extend life, but also we want to make sure patients have good quality of life. So to that extent, I think there was an analysis from the first trial, just as a reminder, the first trial is the one which was done by the French group, looking at giving Revlimid long-term versus Revlimid for 18 months versus melphalan, prednisone, and thalidomide. Now, this was presented at last ASH and showed that the lenalidomide dexamethasone was superior to the melphalan, prednisone, and thalidomide in the older patients. So in this particular analysis, what they were able to show was that the patients getting the lenalidomide dexamethasone had better quality of life compared to the ones who were getting melphalan, prednisone, thalidomide. So I think, even though the result itself may have been along the expected lines, the fact that we are starting to look at that in a lot of these clinical trials is certainly highlights the fact, that we are all cognizant of the impact of quality of life or impact of treatment on quality of life. So those, I think, were kind of the highlights of the meeting. I know it's a lot of different things that I talked about in a short time period, but I can certainly expand on things as we go along the later part of the session.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Doctor. One of the things that I saw at yesterday's presentation by Dr. Duryea. He had a presentation with the his organization, and his very first slide happened to be your slide, which had to do with how survival has gone from before 2005, then after 2005. And then he put another line up there, which was after 2010. And I was wondering, did you provide that information for him for 2010? Because it looked to me like we're all going to be living a happy life, given that information.
No, I think the data that we have goes only up to 2010. Beyond that, we really don't have very long-term follow-up. Or 2011, beyond that, we really don't have really long-term follow-up to make any kind of judgments at this point. But I think looking at the trend...
did you see that graph, by the by, or no?
No, I did not.
Oh, okay. So he extrapolated, perhaps, huh?
I suspect that may be the maybe that is where we want to be.
Oh, okay. Because it was pretty impressive. I was going to ask you about that. I was going to say, yay.
Oh, we'll get there. It's a matter of time.
Okay, you need to see that from. But, he showed it, and even the first two graphs, which were, I think, before 2005 and after 2005, were pretty impressive, I thought, for Mayo Clinic.
Yes.
But when I compare that to what's on the SEER database,
right,
obviously Mayo Clinic is significantly above that. So, that difference, and I was wondering, and I don't mean to give you a question that you haven't seen before, but, why is there such a big difference between what your results are and what the average SEER facility is?
Right.
Can you explain that?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, that is to be expected. And the fact is, the SEER probably captures everybody, and that is probably closer to the truth if you look at it as a community. What happens with the, I don't think it's just Mayo Clinic data. I'm sure if you look at any of the referral institutions, the data is going to be much better than the SEER. Because what happens is many of the older patients elect not to go to a referral center tend to be treated more in the community. They tend to not have very aggressive therapy. So if somebody decided that they don't want any aggressive therapy, they are less likely to search, get a second opinion, or move to a different institution. So I think we obviously have selecting out people who are likely to do better, primarily because they were well enough to travel, they were younger enough that they felt that they want to take an aggressive approach to treatment of the disease. And many of those factors clearly play a role.
Okay. And that's actually sad, but unfortunately, it sounds like it's true.
Right. I mean, the question
not everybody
is,
gets the same quality of care.
Right.
That Mayo provides, Dana-Farber, you know, and you know, Myeloma Institute for Research and Therapy, and all the best locations, unfortunately.
Right, and more than just the quality of care, I'm not sure if you were to take all those patients who did not come to Mayo and treated them exactly the same way as we would have treated them at Mayo, still those patients probably won't do as well because they are probably more older patients, more other problems, and that may be the reason why they elected not to pursue aggressive path.
Okay. All right, another question from, you know, is that we're a very small population. We're 20,000 newly diagnosed patients of all the people that go to ASCO. Do you feel we're getting adequate coverage at these conferences, that we're getting, you know, getting the progress and the focus that we need at these conferences?
So I would say that, you know, more can never hurt, but having said that, for a disease of the size of myeloma, I think we have a lot of exposure, and I think that partly comes from the fact there's obviously organizations like IMF and MMRF who are always out in the forefront looking out for the interests of patients. But more importantly, I think there's a rapid progress has been made over the few years, and that I think attracts a lot of the pharmaceutical industry to that. And then finally, I think even though it's only 20,000 a year, now we are looking at patients living, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. So that people living with myeloma now have far, far exceeded that number, 20,000. So I think the newly diagnosed patients or patients diagnosed within the past year is increasingly becoming a smaller proportion of the larger group of patients with myeloma.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
So where do you think the future for multiple myeloma treatment is, given your views of ASCO and just Mayo's crystal ball?
So I think we are certainly, you know, the bottom line is we are in continuing to improve treatments. I think the people will continue to live longer with this disease. We certainly have new classes of drugs. So I think the next kind of the wave is going to be these monoclonal antibodies, and they are going to be combined with all the other things that we know worked very well. And the wave after that is probably going to be more of the, you know, the targeted therapies, and then, of course, some of the biological therapies like the viral therapy and the immunological therapy, like the T-cell therapies will also, I think they're all kind of coming to age at this point. But the goal eventually is obviously to get patients to live a normal lifespan, even though we may not necessarily get to a 100% eradication of the disease. If we can keep things under control with good quality of life and a normal, relatively normal lifespan, I think we have achieved the goal that we want to. So I think the future would be like, you know, deciding who needs what therapy. So right now we only had like 4 or 5 drugs, so we were treating everybody the same way. Now as we increase the number of available drugs, I think we have to start looking at which group of patients are going to get the maximum benefit from a given type of treatment. So I think individualizing and personalizing the treatment right from the beginning is what's going to be the future.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I think we'll go on to the questions right now, if you don't mind.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, yeah. Pat, are you online? Pat Killingsworth?
My name is Doctor. I'm here, Gary. Can you hear me?
You bet. Pat, your question?
Well, I want to throw Dr. Kumar a curveball right out of the gate here. I was going to ask about panobinostat, and I'm sure you'll touch on that again, Doctor, but I hear from a number of myeloma patients from all over the world, and this is just an anecdotal observation, but for some reason there seems to be, or my impression is, there seems to be an almost overnight explosion of allotransplants. More and more I'm seeing doctors propose them, and more I'm seeing patients accept the risk and challenges. And like I said, I know it's just an anecdotal observation, but I wondered if, and I don't see a lot of studies about them, and I understand that they're considered too risky for most mainstream patients, but I know a number of high-risk patients, and they go ahead and they take the risk, and they have a donor transplant, and they seem to do pretty well. It's difficult, and it's a challenging road, but a number of them, and even in a salvage therapy role, they seem. I have several friends who have lived now approaching 2 years longer than they were projected to because they underwent a salvage allo. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on all of that. Are allos making a comeback? Is my impression correct, or is it just a coincidence?
No, I think there's several reasons for that. One, you know, the allogeneic stem cell transplant, we know from long-term experience from the bone marrow transplant registries, it's certainly something that works in a small proportion of patients and gives you very long-term survival. Now, it had gotten quite a bit of bad rep, I think, primarily for two reasons. One, we were taking patients way late in their disease stage when they had nothing left to be treated with, and those patients, it's hard for the allogeneic transplant to really give some much benefit. The second reason was we used to use the high-dose chemotherapy or the myeloablative allogeneic stem cell transplant in the beginning, and there was a lot of treatment-related deaths because of the side effects from the high doses of chemotherapy and so forth. Now, both those things have changed over time, so I think now there is a better appreciation of who actually has high-risk disease upfront because of the increased availability of FISH and all those kind of studies. And so the younger patients with the high-risk disease, we talk about allogeneic transplant much more early in the course of the disease. Second thing is I think we have gotten a better handle on managing the complications of allogeneic transplant, either by managing the complications or by using the reduced intensity conditioning regimens. So the proportion of patients dying within the first year from complications have gone from like a whopping 40% down to more in the region of 10% or so. So I think that has made the whole modality a little bit more acceptable. The third thing is there have been several large phase 3 trials that have been done looking at allogeneic stem cell transplant, especially the one with the CTN, which also not only increased the awareness but also increased the possibility of patients going on trial and getting allogeneic transplant. And I think finally we have patients who actually do very well with their first-line therapy and or even the second-line therapy, and they're still in very good shape coming into when you're thinking about what do we do the third line or what do we do second line for these high-risk patients. So I think we have better patients are going into the allogeneic transplant in a much better shape than they used to in the past. So I think overall it all points towards the results being, looking better. We're starting to hear more about these patients. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think we really need to show in a face-to-face comparison that there is a group of patients in whom we can use allogeneic transplant and give results better than what would otherwise be.
Sure. So would you consider, isn't a patient who has relapsed multiple times, at some point, don't they, in effect, become high-risk patients?
They do, yes. And I think a lot of it depends on, you know, what is the duration. So if you have a patient who are getting their fourth treatment 2 years after diagnosis, that's really high risk. Whereas if you're talking about somebody who's getting their fourth therapy 10 years after the diagnosis, that person is not necessarily that high risk at this point. You know, it's got a more indolent kind of a behavior and biology. So you have to take into context what all drugs that person has got become resistant to and also in what period of time.
Sure. The thing that I'm not sure concern is the right word, but it's just, you know, these therapies are all over the map. That's a lot of responsibility to put on a patient. You know, they'll email me and they'll say, "Well, what do you think?"
I know.
You know, and I mean, and one doctor won't even use them for a myeloma patient. Another is pretty quick to jump in. Some are using mini allos. Some are using. I mean, it's just all over the map. And it would be nice to pin things down, narrow things down a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm totally with you on that one. I think, you know, the good thing is we have a lot of options. The bad thing is we still haven't defined what option is good for who. And the data, you know, the only data that you can always kind of hang your hat on definitively are the kind of the randomized type data. And especially in the transplant setting, that's not really there. And so I think, you know, the important thing is to have a very frank conversation about what it entails. And that is often the most difficult part about allogeneic transplant, is to kind of convey what a bad graft versus host disease can be and what it could mean for quality of life.
Sure. Thank you, Doctor. Very helpful. Appreciate it.
And Pat, thank you, as always. You always come up with some great out-of-the-pocket kind of questions. Jack, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely. Your question?
Dr. Kumar, we as patients always look forward one day to the possible shot, and the doctor says, yeah, this will take care of it or at least put you in a remission for a very long time. So with that in mind, the measles viral therapy created lots of excitement from Mayo and Dr. Russell a few weeks ago. But as I understand it, and I guess that's what I'm asking for clarification, it appears if it ends up being a treatment that it would only be effective for patients who have minimal measles antibodies, which if you've had the measles vaccine or measles itself, you probably have lots of antibodies. So as such, do you ever see this being a viable treatment for a newly diagnosed myeloma patient who most likely has measles antibodies?
Right. So I think one of the biggest kind of the hurdles for the future for this therapy, of course, you know, it's very exciting. It's kind of the proof of principle at this point, and it's just, you know, couple of patients in whom we have seen the response. What does it mean for the myeloma in general? I think we need to have more patients treated before we know, one, whom does it really help, and is it a consistent phenomenon or is it a random thing? And even if we see that the clinical trials show that there's a proportion of patients who really benefit, then comes the question, who are those patients and how do we identify them ahead of time? So one of the things that we know already is that the patients who have very high titers of measles antibody typically get this measles virus eliminated right away so that the viral therapy really would not have much of a benefit. So I think, you know, you are absolutely right on the mark in the sense that vast majority of patients with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma would have measles antibody in the circulation. So I think right at this point, given the limited information we have, it seems to be something that we may, at least in the initial stages, look at it in the relapse setting. Now, having said that, obviously there are, you know, we'll have to explore options of, one, can we actually do something before giving the measles virus therapy to suppress the measles antibodies. So who knows? I mean, we haven't done the studies. Maybe in newly diagnosed patient population, after some kind of intense therapy for a few months, their anti-measles titers may go down substantially enough that we can actually treat them now with the measles as kind of a, call it a consolidation or something at the tail end of the additional therapy. So that's one thing. Or maybe at some point we could modify the measles virus to some extent that these antibodies don't really recognize them anymore. So all those, you know, possibilities exist, but I think, you know, that's ways down the lane. Right now I think the goal is to better define what proportion of patients would it be effective, and who are those patients, and how can we identify them prospectively?
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jack. Nick Van Dyke, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
You bet. Your question?
All right. So first, Doctor, thanks for joining us, and of course for all the hard work that you and your colleagues at Mayo do on behalf of all of us. I ask a variant of this curability question pretty regularly, but there's more data than the last time I asked it, so I'm going to ask it again. In April, there was a retrospective Italian study that showed that after 10 years of remission post-melphalan, very few patients relapse, and in their words, this suggests a cure. And in the same month, a Spanish study was looking at deep sequencing for minimal residual disease, and that took patients that were all in complete remission but had different levels of MRD and tracked them. And of the patients that had minimal or no MRD, at 7 to 8 years, none of them, not a single one, lost remission over the following 4 to 5 years. Not a single person experienced disease recurrence. So that points, again, towards a cure. And, of course, my doctor, Barlagi, and some of his diaspora have been saying for years that some subset of the patients are curable with aggressive therapy. Now, obviously, it doesn't work for everybody. There are some people that have challenging disease biology. A lot of people aren't eligible for transplant, and there's no easy cure regardless. But acknowledging that some patients are cured, I would think, would be useful for directing the goals of research. And it wasn't a few years ago that complete remission wasn't even considered the be-all, end-all of markers, and now it is. So, and of course, if it's curable, that also impacts the realities of survivors dealing with health and life and disability insurance. At what point do we reach the stage where a newly diagnosed patient should be told that in some cases it may be curable?
Right. So I think we have known for a long time, right? There are some patients who survive years out from their diagnosis, and we had some of those patients even at the times when they were just using the melphalan prednisone. Obviously, from Dr. Barlogi's group, there has been a lot of data suggesting that maybe a substantially more proportion of patients could get to that flat region of the line. So we certainly are curing a proportion of patients. The question is, you know, we don't have a good sense of how much that proportion has changed over time. Obviously, the new therapies have only been around for the past 10 years or so. So, you know, it may take us another 5 or 10 years to conclusively show that the so-called cured patient proportion have increased. Now, the biggest problem that we face is, you know, they're all different types of therapies, and we find a few patients at the end of the, kind of the end of the treatment who have done very well. But it doesn't tell us whether we should be using treatment A or treatment B or treatment C. And the second thing is, we still don't have a good way of identifying these people ahead of time. If we could identify them ahead of time and decide that they need a particular therapy, then we can tell the patients, yes, there's a X percentage chance that you're going to be cured of this disease. Until that time, I think all we can say is there's, you know, we know that some patients potentially get cured, but we cannot tell you what's going to happen to you. You know, it's kind of saying that you could win the lottery, but we can't predict it. So I think, you know, kind of we are very, very excited to see that that the proportion of patients with long-term remissions. And the question is, maybe these new studies like the MRD testing might help us identify those patients at 5 years instead of at 15 years from diagnosis. So maybe in a few years, we might know from these studies that if you're MRD negative for 2 years continuously or 3 years continuously, that could reflect long-term cure.
So I think that's remarkably even-handed answer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Nick. Cindy, are you there? You're last this time, but you're going to be first next time. But you're always first with me.
Oh, thanks. So I guess my question goes back to that, I guess, debate that keeps on going on about continuous therapy versus a fixed-duration therapy. I guess Dr. Colombo, in his retrospective study, found out that a certain group of people who had the continuous therapy had not only significantly longer progression-free survival, but overall survival. So my question is, should we as patients consider staying on continuous therapy if we can tolerate it, if our quality of life is not being affected? Also, I think his study was with newly diagnosed myeloma patients. Would this be something in a relapse refractory setting? And something that you talked about earlier, he was talking about a progression-free survival too. Could you talk about a little bit what that is and why it's so significant of a marker? And I think I heard in one of the other teleconferences that progression-free survival too might be an indicator in drug approval in Europe. And I guess this is the first time, I guess, maybe the last couple of months I've even heard that term. So could you adjust that a little bit?
Sure. So let's take the whole PFS2 thing first, and then we talk about the fixed versus continuous therapy. So the PFS2 is a So progression-free survival is basically the time that time from the diagnosis for the newly diagnosed patients to the time either the disease comes back or patient dies of something that may be unrelated to the disease. So so just as kind of an explanation of the different terminologies, and they can get confusing. So overall survival is the time from, and again, just from the time from start of therapy to the time the individual passes away. The progression free, the time to progression is the time that's taken from the start of therapy to the time when the myeloma actually relapses. PFS, or the progression-free survival, is a composite of the two because it includes patients who die of unrelated reasons as well as the patients who progress. So if you, somebody were to somebody with myeloma was on therapy and died of a heart attack, they would show up in the progression-free survival, but they will not show up in the time to progression if their myeloma was still in remission at the time when they died. So that's just as a background for these different terminologies. So the progression-free survival, too, is basically the total time from the start of the therapy to the time when they went on a second type of therapy and then the myeloma came back. So if you were to look at two treatments, A and B, so you can look at a scenario where everybody got started on treatment A, and let's say after some time the myeloma came back, and then they got started on treatment B, and the myeloma responded, and then it came back again. So the time from the beginning of therapy to that second time point when they failed the treatment B is what is called PFS2. And the PFS, typically the PFS that we describe typically is the one from the start of therapy A to the end of therapy A, or the progression after A. This should not be confused with the second PFS, which is actually the time from beginning of B to the myeloma coming back. So the reason why the European agencies have also been looking at the PFS2, and again, I don't think they are looking at approving drugs just based on the PFS2, but again, looking at other things as well, is the whole question of what happens if the initial therapy were to significantly impact the ability to use the second therapy. If that was the case, then it would the PFS2 would capture both the beneficial effect of the initial treatment and also the long-term adverse effects of the initial treatment. And that is the reason, you know, where the PFS2 might be of benefit. So, for example, if you were to take, let's say, a drug that has lots of side effects, or let's forget about a drug with lots of side effects. Let's take a drug that you give for, say, 4 years versus you give it for 2 years, okay? So if that drug has, let's say, cumulative effect on the bone marrow, and if at 4 years your bone marrow is badly beaten up compared to if you just got it for 2 years, then whatever treatment you get after 4 years might not work very well, whereas the other group of patients where you gave a shorter duration of therapy, the drug might work very well. And so that second PFS would be significantly longer. So the PFS2 then actually helps kind of capture that part of the long-term effect of the drug. And that is the reason why they are looking at that in addition to the other traditional endpoints that have been used.
Okay.
So I don't know if that made it more confusing or more clear. But
I'm starting. I think I'll need to hear it explained a few more times, but, you know, I'm starting to understand what it means.
All right. So, you know, going back to the question of the continuous therapy versus fixed therapy. Now, Dr. Palumbo's data was pretty interesting. You know, he kind of pooled patients who got very different types of treatments in the non-transplant eligible patient population, and basically looked at people who got a fixed duration of treatment and who got a continuous therapy long term. Now, he was able to show that the overall survival seemed to be better in the continuous therapy versus fixed therapy. Now, I think it raises a lot of very interesting hypotheses, but I don't think it is the answer to that question, primarily because of two reasons. One is we don't know how many of those people who were in that fixed duration of treatment were able to get the same drug that the continuous therapy patients were had access to. So, for example, it included patients who got Revlimid. So we want to make sure the patients who at relapse also got the Revlimid or had access to it. So that's one problem. The second problem is the way that analysis was done. It was a landmark analysis, meaning that we kind of assumed, or we just looked at people who survived the first 1 year and then looked at the difference. And we already know that, you know, when you, from a statistical perspective, when you kind of remove that 1 year from that whole graph, it reduces the power or in this situation, it actually kind of skews the power or the ability for that particular analysis to show a particular outcome. But I think the more, you know, this is the same question that's been kind of asked in the setting of maintenance trials too. So there are several trials that have looked at maintenance in the either in the post-transplant setting or in the without transplant. And the vast majority of them, even though they show a progression-free survival, have not yet shown an overall survival advantage, except for the U.S. trial with the Revlimid maintenance and also one of the Spanish trials that looked at continuous therapy in the older patients. So I think we still need to kind of wait and see what these trials, which have been designed specifically to ask this question, shows before we make any conclusions. But it certainly pushes that, at least highlights that as a very interesting or intriguing question that needs to be answered.
Sure is. It's hard for us patients to make that decision right now, I guess, whether we should continue on therapy or whether we should take a therapy break. It's always hard.
It's always hard. And then the thing is, it always kind of boils back down to the quality of life as well. So we have to kind of see how much of benefit are we getting by taking 2 years of treatment versus, say, 3 years of treatment in terms of, long-term outcome. But at the same time, what the price have you paid for the side effects of the treatment also?
Sure.
So I think it has to be a composite or a cumulative, effect of both things.
Kind of like a seesaw. You have to weigh it up both sides.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy. I really appreciate that. Doctor, I have a question, and then we'll go on to the questions from our listeners. That has to do with a study not too long ago by Dr. Richardson from Dana-Farber, mm-hmm. and also right. Dr. Lionel of Emory University. And they had gone through a number of, and for us who have myeloma, obviously we're considered a very much, want to consider what happens when we become, refractory or and we have relapse. So in the RR, area, they said that in their evaluation of a number of studies that VRD had a 69% overall response rate. And RCD, or Revlimid cyclophosphamide and Dex, had an 81% overall response rate. And then Velcade and doxorubicin had 63%. Thalidomide and doxorubicin and Dex had 76%. All of those, obviously were quite good, and they're basically old line therapies. And then the most recent ones that have come out are the ones for Kyprolis, pomalidomide and Dex, which is 70%, and carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and low-dose Dex at 69%. And if you look at that, and I don't quite understand, but 70 and 69 are really no better than the older line treatment. So are you disappointed in that, or am I looking at this totally incorrectly?
I'm not at all disappointed, because you have to remember that the more recent studies would include patients who have already gone through some of those newer treatments that we studied a few years ago. So if you look at the Velcade Relvimid Dexamethasone trial, you know, that started putting patients on sometime in 2005 or 2006. So at that time, a vast majority of the patients had a transplant. All of them had seen thalidomide. Many of them had seen melphalan-type medications, but they had not seen some of the newer drugs at that time already. Now, when you look at the more recent trials, these are patients who have already seen Velcade, Revlimid, transplant, thalidomide, pomalidomide. So increasingly, the newer and newer studies are looking at patients who have already exhausted a lot more options than what was available at that time. So I'm sure if you were to take the same type of patients who went into the Velcade, Revlimid, Dex study, if you can find them and give them these newer therapies, I suspect you're going to see responses similar to that.
Okay, so it's just a matter of timing, basically.
Correct. It's a matter of what all have they seen before they came into this treatment.
Okay, well, fantastic. That makes it make all the more sense to me. At this point, we'd like to take some of the viewer and listener, not viewer, but listener questions. So, Priya, has anybody got some questions for the doctor?
Yes, thank you, Gary. We have Dana Holmes who's dialed in, and I think she has a question for Dr. Kumar. Dana, you're on air. Please ask your question.
Thank you, Priya and panel members. Hello, Dr. Kumar. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a smoldering, an asymptomatic smoldering myeloma patient.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you, what do I need to know going forward? Should all smoldering patients consider early treatment intervention to possibly delay progression or hopefully even cure the disease if we treat while we are in a lower disease burden state, which may be less heterogeneous? I'm not pronouncing that right. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You know what I mean, though, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I'd like to know, what guidance could you give me?
So there are, I think, few different aspects to the answer. One is, I think, as a blanket statement, all patients with smoldering multiple myeloma should not go on treatment at this point outside of a clinical trial. Because first of all, some of those patients whom we used to call as high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma, with the new definitions of myeloma, they are going to be grouped as myeloma rather than smoldering myeloma. So obviously that group of patients would need treatment, just like the way we would treat newly diagnosed patients. But you bring up a very important point. Can we cure the disease if we intervene early? I think that's a research question, and there are clinical trials that are looking at intense therapy in the high-risk myeloma patients, high-risk smoldering myeloma patients, similar to what we use for smoldering myeloma, to see if that is actually a possibility. Now, if you were to look at this answer to that question from the perspective of the results of the Spanish trial, which looked at the Revlimid Dex treatment in patients with high-risk smoldering, a good proportion of those patients, so-called high-risk smoldering myeloma, would actually end up being called myeloma with the refined definition. The second is that trial still doesn't tell us, you know, it's again a relatively small study, and the question is, do we need to take everybody, or can we just wait and watch and see a particular type of change or look at the tempo and then intervene early? So I think there are still a lot of questions that have not been answered, and how much of the effect is from Revlimid versus just dexamethasone, versus Revlimid alone versus the combination. So I think at this point, I would look at smoldering myeloma patients as three groups. One, who meets the definition of the newly diagnosed myeloma based on the new definition, who should all be treated. Patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma, who should all be treated in the context of a clinical trial participation. And patients with standard risk or low-risk smoldering myeloma, who should just continue to be observed.
Thank you, Doctor. For the subgroup of smoldering patients that are being redefined as early myeloma, hence treatable myeloma, what criteria do they need to meet?
So the three new things that have been added was, if you have a bone marrow with more than 60% plasma cells, if you have a free light chain ratio that's more than 100, and if you have a PET scan or MRI actually showing lesions, then these patients would be considered as having symptomatic myeloma, even though they may not have the typical CRAB, the high calcium, the renal problems, the anemia, or the bone disease.
Is there a threshold of lesions to meet?
Yes, so if we see two or more lesions, then we should consider treating them as myeloma.
Two or more. Very good. Thank you so very much for taking my question. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dana. Listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Kumar, you can please press 1 on your keypad and I can bring you live on air to ask your question. We have a question, Dr. Kumar, from one of our listeners, and it says, what options would you suggest for pancytopenia remaining 1 year after an auto stem cell transplant? And the patient is in a stringent complete response confirmed by a bone marrow biopsy, which did not show MDS or other bone marrow and cytogenic abnormalities. Also, for a standard risk patient who has pancytopenia 1 year after an auto SCT and who is in SCR, would you suggest watchful surveillance over any maintenance use of either lenalidomide, bortezomib, or other maintenance therapy?
Right. So I think the question is, how severe is the pancytopenia? If the pancytopenia is not severe, then I would say just continue to watch, especially since the disease is in remission. If there's a significant pancytopenia that the person is needing transfusions, then you certainly should consider, if they have stem cells stored away, considering reinfusing them. You know, the maintenance therapy, yes or no, would depend more on the underlying disease. If it's one of those high-risk myeloma, then I think certainly should be considered, but again, would be limited by what the blood counts are doing in terms of whether they will be able to tolerate the treatment.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor. If any of the panelists have any questions, you may please go ahead and ask them. We have just a couple of minutes more before we wrap up for today.
Okay. My question has to do with the new flow cytometry for measuring MRD. And I'm not so much concerned about the MRD at this point, but I think I heard rumblings that the new flow cytometry test could also maybe give a signature of a person who will go back to the MDES state and maybe never get into a complete remission but return to the precursor MDES myeloma. Is that true? And if it is, would that test be available commercially soon?
Right. So I think, you heard right. The flow cytometry testing that we do does give us multiple pieces of information. One obviously is whether there's MRD or not, but it also can give us a profile of how much of the normal plasma cells have come back, which is also an important predictor of how long the response might last. And it also can give us some profile as to whether some patients are starting to develop this myelodysplastic syndrome type of changes. So there are multiple pieces of information that the flow cytometry can provide. And obviously, we need more studies to see what's the relevance or the implications of some of those findings.
Okay, now, is that just done inside of the clinical trial now? Or would that test an institution that I go to?
Right. No, I think the flow cytometry is just kind of being, at least the way it's just developed by the Spanish group, is kind of being rolled out across multiple institutions. And we are hoping that over the next few years, it will definitely be incorporated into all clinical trials, but also eventually be incorporated into routine practice as well.
So I could ask you next time I go for an evaluation, to have that test done. Is that a blood test or something done on
It's a bone marrow test right now, yes.
So you have to have a bone marrow biopsy for
that bone marrow test. Aspiration for that, right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you so much. I kept interrupting you there. I couldn't hear you clearly. Thank you so much, Cindy. We have almost, I think, the 1 hour just flown by. Dr. Kumar, thank you so very much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you here with us on Cure Panel. And I thank the wonderful panel, Larry, Pat, Jack, Nick, and Cindy. You people are the best. People, please join us again for our next Myeloma broadcast, which is on 8th July at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And we're having Dr. Roger Tideman as our expert speaker. Please visit curepanel.carefeed.net for details of upcoming shows. And you can always mail me, priya@trilex.com. The link for today's show will be shared with all participants. Thank you and have a great weekend.